what do you want to da da da?
I don't know. What do y'all think we should da da da?
Well, what did we da yesterday?
Yesterday.
All the dolls feel like the same doll these days.
I know.
Like, is ta-da Monday or Tuesday?
Ta-da is Thursday.
Oh no, I forgot to call my mom on her birthday.
Oh no!
No!
These days, nothing is normal and everything is weird. But you could still save big when you switch to Progressive. That won't change. Not ta-da or any da.
Quote ta-da at Progressive.com.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Delhi Decoded. I'm Pritika Khanna, your host, and I'm here with your weekly update from the national capital. In this podcast, each episode we pick a pin code from Delhi and dive into the most famous buildings, landmarks, and stories from that pin code. For those of you who are from Delhi, I'm sure you have some very special memories from these places. For those of you who aren't, don't worry, I'll help you get a peek into the pulse of Delhi.
Hamari apni Delhi.
Hours after the lockdown was announced in March, there were photos and videos of huge crowds of people who had gathered in Delhi's 110092, where Anand Vihar bus terminal is located. For the next few days and subsequent weeks, news channels showed images of lakhs of migrants setting out for their hometowns. Images of people with young children walking back thousands of kilometers are still fresh in my memory. With limited or no savings, staying back in a big city like Delhi was a daunting task for most. In the subsequent weeks, governments both in the center and in the state, along with non-government organizations, made announcements and stepped up efforts to make amends. With employment opportunities coming to an abrupt stop, workers in the informal sector felt the worst impact of this. For example, according to reports, 82% of domestic workers, who are largely women, did not get paid during the lockdown. Now, with restrictions being eased, attempts are being made to revive the economy. I have with me Paramita Sen, who is a research manager at Seva Bharat, where they have been conducting studies on the state of livelihoods in the informal sector in the country.
Hi Paramita, welcome to Delhi Decoded.
Hi Pritika, thank you so much for having me.
Before we start, can you briefly just tell us about the work that Seva Bharat does?
Yes, happy to. So Seva Bharat is a national federation of institutions affiliated with the Seva movement. We are a developmental organization that focuses primarily on women in the informal economy. We work across 18 states in India. In various forms, but primarily a lot of developmental work and work with social enterprises. Focus, the Seva ethos is very much focused on decentralized community-led leadership models. And so that is the primary ethos across our work. Our work ranges from, on one hand, we're talking about leadership and capacity building, to social enterprises, to working on, you know, like making sure that people have access to clean water and rations. So it's a broad range of work, but primarily, I mean, it's all developmental work for women in the informal economy.
So I'm guessing the last few months have been extremely busy for your organization, because given everything that, you know, first the extended lockdown, then, you know, the new guidelines that have come into place, between the economy, work, lives, livelihoods, everything has been impacted. And I'm guessing this impact has been a lot worse for workers in the informal sector, you know, who've already been under stress much before the lockdown also began. How do you see the impact on informal workers based on the studies that Seva Bharat has conducted?
Yeah, I actually joke about this a lot when people ask me. They're like, oh, but you're working from home, so, you know, must be a little easier. And at Seva Bharat, through this lockdown, I mean, yes, we're working from home, but our days have easily become, you know, 14-hour days, because there is just so much to be done right now, and it's very pressing, all our work. So when it comes to the informal economy, we started collecting data on this before the lockdown even started, actually, because we realized that as we were seeing what was happening globally in China and in other countries, we realized that whatever happens, livelihoods were going to be affected a little bit, and we just didn't know what the situation was. So we started collecting data to talk to, you know, women workers from the informal economy across states, just to get an idea of how prepared the informal economy even was for such a lockdown, the concept of such a lockdown. Some of the things we found out were really quite devastating and just highlighted how precarious being a worker in the informal economy is. And then you add the gender dimension in regular times, right? So for instance, some women, some families that we ask, I mean, we speak primarily to women respondents, but we ask about the family because the woman is so closely nested within her family. We ask them, if you can't work, go to work for the next few weeks, how long can you make, you know, how long can you get food? Or if there is a lockdown announced for a week, because this was when, you know, we were thinking of like a lockdown of a week, you know, we were very optimistic back then. We said, will you be able to manage? Do you have enough food at home right now? And nobody has that much food at home because people buy for about 2 or 3 days at a time. That's as much money. And that's like an optimistic thing. Lots of people just buy for one day. They work for a day, buy at night. So these people just didn't have those resources. Sanitation, right? We're constantly talking about washing our hands for 20 seconds a day. But how do you do that when water supply is so erratic in so many parts of the country, right? So people were pretty devastated, I mean, pretty not prepared for the lockdown. And they just, we can't imagine a world in which they could be prepared. However, when the lockdown comes, and it was like, what, 2 months, like around maybe about a month and a half in, we did another report on about 300 women across the country, again, across 12 states. And we were trying to figure out how they were meeting their expenditure, right? Like how they were meeting their expenses. Only 17% of our sample at that point still had savings left. Over 70% of the women that we spoke to were relying on loans from their family and their community. People had run out of the money that they had access to at home. Some people had access to, had money in bank accounts, but the informal economy, the women that we work with, even if you have a bank account, it's something that gets set up and you don't use it very often. People don't really know what to do with a bank account. Also, it becomes very difficult to actually get to a bank in the middle of a nationwide lockdown and draw money out. So even people who have access to banks and stuff, it's not like, you know, ATM cards or debit cards, right? Like, you actually have to go stand in a bank line and get the money out. And that wasn't possible, especially during like proper lockdown. So these are just some of the challenges that I remember facing. People started giving up, you know, certain expenses, you know, like they would started figuring out how to like cut down on food and nutrition. A lot of people just, you know, as a precaution, because nobody had any idea how long, you know, we would need to be in lockdown. So people were giving up vegetables and milk, right? And that has longer term health and nutrition consequences for, you know, workers and for children. But these were like some of the expenses that people were giving up. So the impact was quite severe. And I think the uncertainty of it made the precarity of the informal economy just so much more severe because people just didn't know. You have no idea how much longer you need to stretch your rupee, you know? And that's quite a lot of stress. And stress was another thing, that isolation. It was really pretty hard on the informal economy. Workers, I mean, they're workers that are in their homes already. They have that interaction, and for women to not have that interaction anymore, that was their only space when they went to work. So that support, that community that they had, that all got taken away from them, and the added burden of figuring out how to make budgets last, all falls on women, right? Like, I mean, even if that's not just for the informal economy, like, you know, across India, women are the ones who are trying to figure out how to like balance food and who gets what and how to make sure that, you know, what's in the pantry lasts the family a certain amount of time. It's just that much more compounded with the informal economy. So around May when we checked, it was really pretty bad. It's gotten, I mean, there's now been a certain resumption of business, but really not that much.
So based on the surveys that you've conducted, especially, you know, women who are in sectors like domestic work, which were very badly impacted, what was the kind of response that you got there? Were people being paid? Were, you know, people still receiving their salaries, even though, you know, going, especially during the first 5 weeks that, as you mentioned, going out to work, not even an option because there was such a strict lockdown that was imposed.
Yeah. So from our data, so let's take domestic workers and I'll talk about street vendors. 18% of domestic workers got paid during the lockdown phase. That's it. So for about, and when I'm saying lockdown phase, I'm talking about 2 months, right? Like lockdown in that sense in urban areas, because domestic work street vendors are primarily urban trades, only 18% got paid through the lockdown phase. About half of domestic workers were allowed to come back to work as the country moved into, you know, the different unlock phases. 1/3 of domestic workers had actually lost work they aren't getting back to that work. So, and a large part of the problem there is that people are now, thanks to work from home, they're staying at home and doing the work themselves. So domestic workers have in some ways been made redundant. And I'm putting redundant in like quotes here, right? Because that's not actually how it works. But thanks to the shrinking of the economy just generally, domestic workers aren't getting some of their work back. So there's this woman I spoke to out of West Bengal. She used to work in 6 houses before the lockdown. She now works in 1. Because the other 5, the women are like, we're not going to work anymore. We just do the work ourselves at home. And her husband's a day laborer, so he doesn't have any work. And so there are some challenges with that. Some domestic workers who commute are having a really hard time because even though the country has opened up in some ways, like in Delhi, there is no metro. So how do you figure out some work things? Buses, you know, you have to like, they're going on limited lines, there are limited people who can get onto a bus. These are important challenges for women who have to commute to get to work. Street vendors, 90% of street vendors surveyed, there has been no business for them, like no business whatsoever. Those who were able to do any work with vegetables and like produce vendors, but that's only about 10% of street vendors. The other vendors just, you know, there's nothing. And even now, as we're trying to open up, we're trying to, so say that Delhi, for instance, in Delhi, we work with some communities to open up a Mahila Haat and a book bazaar. And we figured out, you know, how to do it socially distanced and everything. So, you know, the vendors aren't really, you know, like sitting on top of each other. There's some space. We've set up like hand sanitizing systems. But there are no customers. And none of us are going out as customers to go to these big open bazaars, right? So even if people are managing to get back onto the street, there are no customers. Even now, through this renowned what, unlock 4? 4,
yes.
Yeah, so I mean, these are just these challenges, right? Like trying to figure out how to get out there, even as we're trying to like support the street vendors, you're figuring out supply, but demand continues to be an issue.
My next question is actually related to that. Enough steps were taken to safeguard workers in the informal sector during this time?
The simple answer is no. The longer answer is, enough steps are never taken to safeguard workers in the informal sector. As a crisis, I realized that this was unprecedented. Nobody had any idea what to do here. But informal workers are usually, I mean, there's very little that is done to really support them in that sense, right? Just the fact that they're informal workers, the social protection that, like, you know, that they should be given as workers, their rights, they're all a little bit... it's always a little bit behind the curve on what it should be, right? Like the social security net. And it's not that the state isn't trying it, it's just it's very erratic, right? So you have PDF systems all across Delhi, right? And you have ration systems everywhere. But for instance, until the lockdown, many of the PDS shops just weren't functioning on a regular basis. So a lot of people stopped relying on them, right? Because sometimes the PDS, you know, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. It's erratic. It's not that there isn't a PDS shop, it's erratic. So a lot of workers have figured out, you know, like because of their work, they were managing, they were making do elsewhere. But through this lockdown, that wasn't an option. And that becomes an added pressure on the PDS system. Data was outdated at that point because a lot of people, even though they have ration cards, hadn't been using the PDS system. So it's gaps like that, right? It's not that there isn't... It's not that there's a complete absence of a social security net for workers in the informal sector. It's just that it's very erratic. And the state is hard-pressed to reach the vulnerable, to reach the marginalized. You have to really get into communities to be able to do that. And the state just doesn't have that last mile that we talk a lot about in social science and in this kind of developmental work. It's that space there that we haven't, as a society, as a global society, we haven't cracked. Workers were missed out over there. That's really where the impact was. And it's not new to COVID. It's something that has always existed, but COVID just really exacerbated the impact because there were no other alternatives for workers in the informal sector. I have other alternatives. I can switch to working on Zoom, for instance, but a street vendor can't. The street vendor can't be like, "Acha, yahan pe ration nahi mil raha hai. I'll just go quickly switch. You know, I'll go do an extra day of work, or I'll work overnight, or I'll pick up a second job as a construction worker." So it's things like that that really caused the challenges for workers going into the lockdown.
So just taking that forward, what do you think is needed at this point to support workers in the informal sector,
especially? So honestly, when it comes to supporting workers, right, in the informal sector, We do have a lot of things. A lot of it is, so one of the things that we've seen, for instance, is different schemes and different kinds of loans to support street vendors or to support micro entrepreneurs, right? And that's something that we want to encourage. At SEVA, we're very clear, and thanks to the SEVA model, we've noticed and we've said that the best way to really support the informal economy is to have them be participants in the decision-making process, right? And that's one of the things that we really stress. Because otherwise, you know, you and I can sit here, or, you know, people can sit in like fancy offices and do things. We're like, oh, this is what will work. But it doesn't actually work once it gets down to like the ground realities, right? And it's a longer process, maybe it's a slower process, but get informal economy workers actually involved in the process, right? Of what is it that they need. Some of the things that we have seen from our data is micro entrepreneurs, for instance, saying that, you know, loans, not just to start their business, but also to help them, for instance, with getting a cell phone, right? Like a very basic smartphone, because as the world is getting digital, women need to get digital as well. And in India, the digital gender gap is really quite severe, right? So for instance, just like off my head, I believe 15% of women in India have access to smartphones as compared to 34% of men. The digital gender gap, I mean, if there's a digital gender gap, but there's also a class gap. And as we all move to figuring out how to do things online, we really need to figure out how to help support these women in getting that those basic resources. So it's not just about, here's a loan so you can buy more produce to sell, buy more raw goods to sell, but it's also like, here are some means for you to sell them. Getting people access to markets, right? And figuring out how to make it easier for people to access markets. And in this, and now digital markets maybe, but other things like, you know, removing some of the paperwork. There's so much paperwork. And then for people who aren't really, who haven't had the privilege of, you know, fancy education, paperwork becomes challenging, right? Like, how do you really reduce the red tape on that end and make it simpler? And the answer over there isn't, let's figure out how to do it through an app. Because again, digital gender gap, right? Like that's the balance. We have to figure out what is that easy way of bringing and making it easier for informal economy workers without relying on what have now become easy solutions. Like, you know, or we'll do it digitally. Digital doesn't help the informal economy. And you know, it's small things like that. As I mentioned, loans, some level of social security. And in SEVA, what we have noticed that has really worked in supporting the informal economy where it is been decentralized local governance, right? So through lockdown, because, I mean, it was a lockdown, right? Like, no one was being able to go anywhere. I spend most of, like, you know, SEVA, we do a lot of work in our communities, but I was stuck in Delhi. So any ration work that got done, any, you know, ration and relief work that was done entirely at the local level by local community leaders partnering up with municipalities and ward panchayat and ward parishads and gram panchayats and working with them in collaboration to make sure that the communities were fed, right? So for instance, let's take Delhi. So in Delhi, in some of the communities that we work in, the government reach into every, you know, informal settlement in Delhi to try and figure out who needed food where. That is where, I've got some case here, but I'm sure this exists in other places. The NRLM and SRLM models have done a lot of great work in this. But essentially, our community leaders, because they were in that community, they knew which families needed what. They knew which families didn't have food, who was out of a job, who didn't have savings. So they would make the lists, send them up, you know, send them out of the communities through like the one, you know, one smartphone through WhatsApp. And that's how the government figured out, okay, in this settlement, this is how much food we need to get sent. They will connect it up and get it sent. And the community leaders, the women, would distribute it to the people who actually needed it. So they were ensuring that no hoarding was taking place. They were ensuring that the truly marginalized were actually getting this food, making sure that there was equitable distribution. And it was that combination, you know, of the community working with the that was so powerful. Anywhere that we've seen communities pulling through has been because of this collaboration that was done entirely at the local level and through local initiators. Just seeing that, like, this is something that happens all the time, but through COVID, you really see how valuable that is because, you know, effectively, a lot of us were not needed in this process. Once you give communities, you know, give over decision-making power to them, they figure this stuff out. Yeah. So moving forward, how do we scale this up a little bit more, right? Like, how do we scale it up? How do we make them active participants in these decisions and in these processes? But they will then stitch this together themselves.
This was also, I think, with COVID, it was also a necessity because everything, you know, when it was everything just suddenly shut down. So, you know, people had to step up because everyone at one point, I know in March was just like, you know, everyone was confused as to what is going to happen. I think it's also sort of like a necessity that COVID made happen in this case.
Exactly. I mean, it sucks to say this, right? Like, I don't want to go around saying that, oh, look, COVID has a silver lining, because that's just such a privileged thing to say. But the way I see it is that COVID really highlights some of the challenges, but also some of the things, you know, modalities that have been working, they just highlighted. It's just been working quietly in the background, and now you're seeing that maybe those are the only things that can work long term. And I think it really draws attention to that of communities to make their own decisions.
True. Another thing that seems to have, you know, happened with COVID is that people are now more focused on local products. It's, you know, more about, you know, you'll go to whatever's available around you. It's not, you know, people are not focusing on like bigger brands and companies anymore. It's about, you know, your local products, local produce. Do you think at the end of the day, I know, as you also mentioned, there are a lot of technical difficulties that will come in the way. But do you think that, you know, in some way, this could be a silver lining for the informal sector?
I think so. And I think it's a necessary silver lining, not just for the informal sector. I mean, of course, for the informal sector, but I think that going local is something that, you know, we as a globe need to come to terms with and figure out how to do. You know, like one of the things, the benefits of investing local is like you're just cutting down on so many unnecessary costs and the overheads and the impact on, say, something like the climate and all of that. And not to be that real environmentalist person here, but that's a really important consideration for us, right? Because when you're talking about things like climate change and you're talking about a resource crunch, it's the informal sector that bears the brunt of it, right? I mean, as Delhi grapples with the water crisis, you know, people living in, say, GK or LCR Park, which is where I live, we're going to face the water crunch a lot later than a Harkish Nagar or a Gubi Nagar, right? Like their water crunch, I mean, that is going to go, is going to be taken away first from the informal sector and then only from, you know, the middle class. So there's that concern. But one of the things that we've noticed in our time here working with the informal economy is that once that decision-making power goes to women in the economy, in the informal economy, they invest back in their economy, right, in the local economy. So a micro-entrepreneur, right, a woman micro-entrepreneur, she takes a loan to start a business. Instead of prioritizing how to scale and how to reach, like, a large market, she prioritizes investing locally, giving money, giving a job to her neighbor, giving a job to, you know, the person, to the driver in her community, as opposed to figuring out, you know, how to cut costs and increase profits. She'll give up some of her profits, her profit margin, to make sure that the community thrives along with her. That there's real investment, you know, there's very much like a rising tide, raises all boats kind of a thing, you know. And I think that's a really, I mean, not only is it a very powerful statement on behalf of this, you know, this woman micro-entrepreneur who does it, I think that's just one of those things that allows us to reimagine the world through her eyes and figure out that, you know, like investing in a community and making sure that the benefits of something like business is distributed equitably across the people who live around you, I think really is an important lesson, is an important way to look at the world that we learn from these leaders when it comes to like egalitarian distributions of profits and income and access to benefits and privileges.
My next question actually is something that you've touched in parts in various questions, but when the lockdown was announced, I think Delhi was one of the first few states which saw a large number of migrants leave for their home states. Also given the fact, you know, that Delhi is a migrant city, and there are very few people who actually come from Delhi. What do your surveys show about Delhi?
When it comes to the migrant situation? So, I mean, as you've already mentioned, right, a lot of people in Delhi moved out. It was staggered. It was very staggered, right? So some people tried to stay on and hold on for a little bit. They would take loans. But eventually, yes, you know, the lockdown continued extending. We started seeing more and more people leaving the city. The consequences of this is that we're not sure of how they'll be coming back. Right. So when it comes to like trying to figure out, so people left the city and because of the Seva Network, and as I mentioned, we work in, say, 18 states, right? So I'll use a couple of examples of people who left from Delhi and finally made their way back to Bihar, which is where we also work. So we can pick up with them and their story over there. Some of the challenges for them is trying to figure out how to come back, you know, and what the costs are of coming back. Moving to a city like Delhi, it takes a lot, right? Like, migration is not an easy decision for people to make. So moving here, setting up networks, setting up work, these are challenges for women, for people. Women, for instance, aren't even considered migrants in many cases because they come as becomes a wife or a daughter. So they aren't even considered migrants. That's counted. She isn't counted herself. So, you know, that's like a whole other problem. For them to move back and then try to figure out how to bring the entire family back, does the entire family come back? Or does the woman stay behind in Bihar while the husband comes ahead and figures out, you know, like how to revive his livelihood? These are some of the challenges that we're seeing. And the largest thing through all of this is that as you see people leave the city, they're losing access to a lot of the, you know, the benefits that they had built up. So PDS cards, like ration cards, aren't transferring. They're not being able to figure out how to transfer it. Given the way the informal economy works, we're not even being able to track some of this data because phone numbers have changed. And it was easy when we lived in, you know, a new Ashoknagar because, you know, we would just go out there and ask them about their lives. But now that they've moved back to, say, Darbhanga, I don't know how to talk to her. I don't know where she's gone. I don't know how to trace the impact of this, or the longer-term impacts of this on her life. I know where she moved, and I know when she moved. She moved, you know, 6 weeks out into the lockdown. She said that there was no food, at least if they would go back home. They had a little bit of, you know, Kepika land, and they could, you know, at least grow something and eat it. But I don't know how, you know, what are the means of getting her back? Does she want to come back? Are we just seeing, like, you know, one-way migration? And what the impact this has on the Delhi economy, you know, moving forward? I realize that they're informal economy workers and we maybe don't recognize them as such, but these people make up Delhi, you know, like informal economy workers are as much part of the Delhi fabric as the political class here in Delhi or any of us, you know, who with jobs in the formal economy. What happens to our construction? What happens to our vegetables? What happens to the vending? What happens to domestic work if the informal economy has gone back? There are so many trades that keep the Delhi economy moving. And we're not able to trace this because of the consequence of migration. The way migration in India has worked through this lockdown, we're losing data as we speak. And as recently, we haven't figured out how to track that.
Yeah, I remember a few months back, there was a survey that was done with the number of students that are missing from Delhi government schools. And there were about 25% students who either could not be traced because they'd moved back to their hometowns or did not have access to, you know, mobile phones, which help you get education in such a time. Puts into perspective how we don't have any idea of how many people have just gone, you know, all over the place. We just don't have numbers available.
Yeah, we don't have the numbers. I mean, 25%, I mean, that, and again, I mean, that, first of all, that's a really great proxy. I love that. It's a really great way to try and figure out, like, try to get a handle on it. But again, that is assuming the people who do have access to schools, like the ones who even managed to get into a Delhi government school. When you're talking about the most vulnerable of the informal economy, their children aren't even getting into Delhi government school. So what happens to them? What happens to them?
Yeah.
This is like the upper echelon of the informal economy who get into Delhi government school. So the numbers are really quite significant. And we don't know that. We don't know enough about it. And we don't know how to. Like, the impacts of this on the informal economy are going to be really quite long lasting.
That's very true. My last question. You know, there are, over the last few months, there have been various announcements that have been made to sort of boost the economy. Especially when it comes to street vendors, the central government has announced a scheme for easy access to loans. There were also some measures that, you know, included providing free ration, which were announced through, you know, lockdown and after that. Do you think that such schemes were able to, and, you know, in case of, like, say, loans and all, are currently having an impact on the ground? Do you think they're able to reach the client, you know, reach the people that they're actually made for?
Further when it comes to reaching the people that they're made for. So some of the challenges with all of this, again, is documentation and figuring out access, right? So when you're talking about, say, a scheme for street vendors, so street vendors are something that was passed, like, recently. So, you know, give it some time to maybe keep into full effect. But let's say the construction worker Because for the team, the construction workers would get 5,000 rupees back in. Yeah, April. Some of the challenges with that is a challenge that's just inherent in the informal economy, right? And it's lack of documentation. You have to be registered as a construction worker ahead of time to have gotten access to that through the construction worker welfare bill. When it comes to the informal economy, not a lot of people have that access to documentation. Not a lot of people are registered. Micro laborers, you know, it becomes very hard for them to be registered because where do they register? You're coming from Jharkhand, you're working early this month, but then you might, you know, like might go to Bombay for the next bit of work, right? When it comes to women, women aren't considered workers in many cases because they're supporting, you know, like they're doing like some chula ka kaam and things like that. The kind of work that women in the informal economy do is also not even recognized as work by themselves, right? I mean, that's one of the things that is a massive challenge. Women workers don't even recognize and register that they themselves are workers who are contributing productively to the economy and workers, you know, in the full sense of that word. So they aren't registered with things. So when you aren't registered, then how do you access these schemes? You know, like how do you figure out if you're eligible or not? A lot of business, you know, a lot of the livelihoods in these in the informal economy, a lot of the times it's family oriented, right? So if it's like the street cart, or a street cart that sells fruits, right? Or a shop, or snacks or something, it's a man who's selling it, it's a woman who's doing all the work at home and making it out. But the scheme would be for him. Recognize him as the worker. Because officially that's what it is. We're undercounting the work that the woman is doing at home who's busy making the aloo for the pitchfas, you know? So, like, again, just inherent challenges that we have in the informal economy at all points of time, things that are coming out now aren't going to be able to fully address the impact because we don't know what the impact is. If we've never counted that woman as an informal economy worker, how do we then come up with a scheme to get to her? Right? Like, how does the government come up with the scheme? So trying to figure out who the worker is and what the breadth and depth of work in the informal economy is, is really figure out what, you know, how do we make sure that our citizens aren't being left behind. Free rations, again, like all of these things, even if you come up with a great scheme, you have to make sure the system works. And as I said, the system didn't work at some point. Now trying to reach out to people and getting them re-registered. So through the lockdown, we're trying to get people re-registered with Aadhaar cards and Janjan accounts. So Janjan accounts, right? The Janjan account scheme, which is, you know, a way for women who have Janjan accounts, they were going to get 500 rupees from the government, right? A lot of women had let the Janjan accounts lapse because they aren't used, they're not really integrated in the banking system. Every time somebody went through the drive, great. But after that, you know, financial literacy is low. We are distant from the banking system, we're living in foreign areas, I mean, rural communities or something, right? You know, you don't really have access to a bank. So the bank account is gone and has lapsed, which means you didn't get that 500 rupees. And you're probably the one that needs it. So when it comes to how to have an impact on the ground, I think the ground realities are so complicated. There's a lot of need for good data, and there's a lot of need for with stakeholders, right? Like talking to the informal economy, figuring out what is happening. Janjan accounts, there's many Janjan accounts, and that's a good number. You're like, okay, yes, great. Of course, it's a good way to reach out, but that is until you realize that women have let their Janjan accounts lapse. And at that point, what do you do? You can't reactivate a Janjan account in the middle of a lockdown.
How much there has to be, you know, it just goes to show how much needs to be done on the ground even now. And you
yeah.
only just
surface. Yeah, I'm kind of hoping, you know, like the, I mean, it's awful, but the lockdown in some way is causing us to realize that there's this crisis of the informal economy globally, right? It's not just India, but globally. You know, service workers and things. So migration, like the migration problem, situation in India, people have no idea just, you know, how precarious migrants' lives were under the lockdown, and you see them, you know, traipsing back thousands of kilometers to get home. And I think this is a moment for us to, like, you know, maybe wake up and realize some of these challenges and bring some of the best minds in the country to work on it. You know, I'm hoping we don't lose this momentum.
True, definitely. That's one thing that, you know, this pandemic has given us, is made us realize how much we were not aware of and how much that needs to be done.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you so much for joining us today and leaving us so much to think about.
Yeah.
That's all from me this week. I'll be back next week with a new PIN code. Until then, please like, subscribe and share this episode. We are always looking to hear your thoughts and suggestions. We're ever present on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at HT Smartcast. You can also reach out to me directly on Twitter at Pritika Khanna. Thank you so much for joining in. See you next time. Until then, stay safe and healthy.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.